What actions will inspire someone to make a better life for themselves? Those of our childhood heroes, our friends and parents, or a complete stranger can have a lasting impact, but how about a video game? Growing up, Kyle Warner dealt with many daily challenges. As a teen, he was looking after his clinically depressed mother, they lost their home, and his older brother had a drug addiction. But the video game, Downhill Domination, and Eric Carter's character in that game sparked something in Kyle. Kyle fell in love with the sport. Once he got a bike, riding became a positive outlet, bringing joy and an escape from the trouble at home. He declared mountain bikes were going to be my way of life, and set goals to become a professional racer. Now he's shifted his focus from racing to helping others get into the sport. His YouTube channel has grown rapidly, and an active community of followers share stories of saved marriages and new direction in life. Kyle's story is one that I'm excited to share. It's humbling, emotional, and left me speechless several times. He's a great human, genuine, soft-spoken, and motivated to help people by spreading the positive impact that bikes can have. I'm AJ Barless. Welcome to the latest episode of the NSMB podcast and my conversation with Kyle Warner. Kyle, welcome.
Hey, how's it going, AJ?
Good, man. How's it going down there?
Good. I'm excited for winter to kind of slowly be phasing out. It's ready to ride a little bit more.
But... Awesome. So Boise's pretty cold right now, or?
Yeah, it's been off and on. Like I don't know. It's kind of good because I grew up in California, you know, and so I was used to my whole life up until the last few years, like you just ride all year. And then now having that like forced time off, you know, some people still are crazy and they go ride in the ice and snow and whatnot, but I just will take a little bit off, and it's actually pretty cool because then you get so rejuvenated for springtime.
Yeah, you get keen.
Yeah, it has like its pluses and minuses, but right now I'm like ready for it to be done. So
so no snow studs for you in the wintertime?
I don't know. Like I tried skiing and snowboarding a little bit and it's fun, but I'm like my mind wants to go faster than my skills are ready for. So, you know, you'll see lines in the trees and stuff. You're like, oh, that'd be sick. Like I could do this and this, and then you just wad up. So I'm like, try not to get hurt, but... Yeah, I actually have been working with a company called Snowgo, and they do kind of like it's not really a snow bike, but kind of similar. And yeah, it has three skis, and that thing's been super fun. Like Nikolai Rogatkin is a big fan of that, and Reed Boggs has one too, and they ride a lot. So it's been.
Have you been out on that a lot this year?
Not this year, but last year I went quite a bit. So yeah, I tested some like powder skis for them, and that was really fun. So trying to get more into that, but.
Where are you taking that thing up?
So like what's cool is that's the only ski bike that's kind of certified all over the US now. So it got endorsed by the PSIAA, which is the Professional Ski Instructors of America. And basically that is kind of, it's almost like the e-bike of the snow world, which can be a controversial topic, right? But yeah. It's kind of like the way that they explained it to me is every single year, 3 million Americans try skiing or snowboarding for the first time and 85% never go again.
Wow.
So 85% of people try it, they fall a bunch that day and they're like, I'm done, this sucks. So what they're trying to do is basically the ski industry has been progressively shrinking every year. So it's actually retracting versus like the mountain bike industry, which is growing. And so they're trying to figure out as an industry, how do we kind of retain more people? Because if we have 3 million people a year trying it and 85% are leaving, then like, how do we retain some? So it's kind of like like skis with handlebars and almost like a scooter bike hybrid, but it's really fun. So if you ever get keen to check it out, it's cool. But they're all over kind of now. They got partnered in with a bunch of the big ski resorts in the US.
I tried snow biking when I used to work up on Whistler Mountain, and it didn't go well. I hyperextended my elbow and I was like, I'm not doing this again.
It looks deadly, honestly. Like I haven't tried a two ski snow bike yet, but every time I see one, it just looks so deadly. But maybe I'll have to give that a shot too. But
well, that's cool. All right. So let's get into a bit more sort of bikes on dirt.
Okay.
I thought maybe we could start with a warm up, although we've had a pretty good little warm up go there already. But I will jump into these anyway because I think some of them will be interesting to hear from you. So these are kind of rapid fire style of questions just to get going. I've got maybe five or so. So first one is long travel bike or small?
Oh man, I guess that would be just defined by what long travel is. But for me, if I could only have one bike, I'd probably have somewhere between a 130 mil 29er or like a 150 mil 27.5. I find like that's kind of the sweet spot for a lot of things I like to do, where you can still jib on it and have fun and still ride some gnarly stuff. Like I've raced Whistler a couple times on, you know, 130, 140 bikes, and it's not too bad. So that would be my go-to. But I want to try to build up like an old school, really long travel bike, like a 12 inch travel one, just for fun, for some videos.
That'd be awesome.
Yeah. But no, I think, yeah, like kind of mid travel would be where I'm at.
Cool. What bike do you spend the most time on then?
So Niner is this, like our sponsor, and I ride the Rip 9, which is a 140 mil 29er. Yeah. And that bike's sick. It's been really fun because it kind of, I don't know, it was the first bike I've ever ridden where the front triangle is so laterally stiff that when you corner, like where your hand is, your front wheel is always like exactly in relation to your hand. So it doesn't have that weird like front deflection. And right. It took a minute to get used to, because I actually tried it with carbon wheels at first and it was so stiff I was struggling. And then I went to aluminum wheels and that bike's been super rad. Like I've done well on pretty much every race I've used it on, and I was surprised. I'm like, oh, this is so sick.
Yeah, you take well to the more direct input, I guess.
Yeah, just it's weird having like where your feet, your hands, and your front wheel are, that triangle is like so laterally stiff. It's like always there. So it's easy to count on. And that was kind of an eye-opener for me. I'd always been more of a flexi frame guy. I really like that. I always would try to ride aluminum frames if they were available from sponsors. So that was kind of cool. But I love that Rip 9.
Cool. What about a bike that you wish you could spend more time on?
Oh, man. I feel like I wish that I had a downhill bike sometimes just to go play. And I don't know, it's probably just because I haven't had one in so long, you know, that I miss it. Because that's how I came up, was racing downhill. And then 2011, I think I made the switch to enduro, or 12, and then haven't really owned a downhill bike since then. So yeah, it's been a long time.
Yeah, that is a long time. Yeah. I thought you were going to say like a dirt jump bike or something, because you're so good on those. That's a good answer.
Yeah. Yeah, we have the Boise Bike Park here in town, and it's like 20 minutes from my house. So I'll go down there on the dirt jumper a few times a week and just play. So nice. I get a bit of time on that. But I feel like the older I get, the more I roll my ankle with my dirt jumper. So that's been tough too.
Yeah. So being in Boise, you kind of have both ends of this: cold and tacky dirt, or dry and loose?
Oh, dude, I'm always like dry and loose. I love that stuff. Yeah, like dirt surfing. That's kind of where I grew up doing. And I don't know, it's just fun. I like the fact that it's unpredictably predictable. Like, you know it's always going to be loose. So it's like,
I know
you can
exactly
just count on
what
that.
You mean. Yeah.
Yeah. You're like, I don't know what's going to happen, but I know it'll move. So that's been fun. But yeah, I grew up racing North Star, which is in Tahoe and California, and then Mount Shasta. And that place is crazy, right. Pumice. So it was fun.
Another one that's pretty good for based where you are: open plains or deep forest?
I like the forest, honestly, because I don't know, it's hard. Like with open plains, like what we have out here, the average speed of a lot of the trails is over 20 miles an hour,
right?
You know, and so it's pretty quick. But what that means is you climb for 2 hours and you descend for 20 minutes or 10 minutes. So I like deep forest because you can get like a nice hour long climb and then you can ride for 20-30 minutes through the trees. So that's really fun. I love that stuff.
Cool. Working on skills or having a blast and not caring?
I don't know, I like skills. I think it's fun just to, like the other day, I guess it was a while ago now, but I took my rear brake off and just did a full day of only front brake, trying to practice cornering with like using your front brake to brake in the straight line and let off around the corners.
And on trails?
Yeah, on trails. Like we have a really cool slalom track, and I just practiced for, I think, a full day with just no rear brake, like actually took it off the bike, and it made it fun because it was so different. It was like a fun challenge. And I don't know.
What did you discover?
I mean, okay. So I was at a race in the North American Enduro Cup, and this kid, Carson Eiswald, he's like super pinned, one of the fastest American Enduro racers. And his front brake rotor was like completely smoked, and the rear one was fine. Huh. Yeah. And he comes from moto, and I was like, dude, your front rotor is like roached. He's like, yeah, it's brand new, I just put it on. And he uses the front brake so much. And then when I got home from that race, I was like, man, I kind of want to practice that a bit. But it's good because it really helps you kind of focus on braking and then letting off completely instead of like modulating around the turn. But
right.
Yeah, it's definitely, you have to pick certain trails to do it on, but
yeah.
It was,
you want to dive into something steep and just end up over the bars.
Yeah, it was cool though. It was super fun.
Huh. Last one, and this kind of points into more of what we're going to talk about. Riding, helping others ride, or connecting with fans and supporters.
Oh, man, definitely helping kids figure out new things or adults figure out new things. It's really fun. And I don't know, like anytime we go to the bike park and there's a kid, you can see they want to hit, like there's this main wall ride. That's kind of the first jump on the intermediate line at the Boise bike park. And yeah. I've helped so many people just tow them through that. And it's so cool to see them get all stoked on it. And I don't know, it's just, that stuff's fun. Like I have more fun with that than riding. Cause I've ridden so much for myself in my life, you know, that I'm like good on that. You know, it's fun to go ride, but it's more fun to help people with just learning new things, you know?
Cool. You get a real buzz out of just seeing someone stoked and progressing.
Yeah. Cause it's like, I don't know. I'm at the point now where I'm 28 years old and I feel like I've been doing it full time since I was about 16. And it's hard now to get those little rewards where you have, you know, like for me to do something completely new would be very risky, like pretty dangerous to do something I haven't done before. So it's hard to push those boundaries all the time. And then when you see a little kid hit like something that's relatively safe that they're scared of, and then they get over that fear and it's like, they're so stoked. It just brings you back, you know? But for now, it's like on stuff that I want to do that would give me that same buzz, it's like really dangerous. So I don't tend to do it as much.
You don't feel like the reward's there for yourself?
Yeah, because it's like we're trying to do so many other things at the moment that sometimes you're kind of, I weigh that out. And then as soon as I weigh that out, I'm like, oh, I'm not in the right mindset for it. Yeah. Whereas before, you're just like, yeah, just send it. Like that's what I want to do. So yeah, it's weird. I feel like I've aged a lot in the past year and a half, 2 years, which is weird. But it's all good. It's cool to help people for sure.
Sweet. So on that, you brought up a couple of things that I want to dive back into. You've got heaps going on and we're going to have plenty to talk about, but I want to help people understand a bit more about how you got to where you are today. So do you want to dive back and tell us a little bit about what got you into bikes and your background there?
Yeah, for sure. So I know I've told this story a few times, but you know, it's basically what got me into bikes was it was an outlet to help me kind of escape from everything that I had going on at home at the time. So I was in high school and it was a really trying period of life where like, you know, the 2006, 2007 market crash that happened in the US, like the economy tanked and that was really gnarly. And my mom and I lost our house and my brother, who was working in real estate at the time, he got pretty severely damaged financially through that whole thing. And he actually fell into like drug addiction and became a meth addict. So he's 13 years older than me. So my mom, we got evicted. She was having a hard time. She's clinically depressed. So we were fighting the eviction, being homeless. My brother turned into a meth addict and I was like failing out of school because every night I would just kind of be trying to deal with my mom and just figure out how to be the adult of the house. Cause like my mom and dad split up before I was born. So that they're out of the picture. It's just me and my mom. My brother's so old, he's out of the house. And from the age of like 14, 15 years old, I was kind of like in charge of making sure everything was okay. And then, you know, to not really have a positive outlet with everything else going on, you know, a lot of kids will kind of fall in the wrong direction, but it kind of luckily my brother was an example at the time of what not to do. So I saw him battling through that. And I was actually playing American football at the time. And, you know, I had a really fun team. We had a good time. That was like my outlet. And then when I went to be a sophomore in high school, the coach was a little bit rough on the kids, like just verbally. And, you know, I was already dealing with so much at home, then coming to practice and getting yelled at and chewed out the whole time. And then it made me kind of lose passion for it. So I quit football because I was like just so tired of just always having conflict. And then I picked up a bike. And what was cool about the bike is like no one could tell you when to practice, whether you're doing it right, whether you're doing it wrong. You know, it's just like fully a creative pursuit. And that was kind of what I latched onto. And then started out riding street BMX and all that. And after about a year of kind of riding all the time, these older guys saw me out at the dirt jumps one day and they were part of the collegiate mountain bike team. And they just kind of said, dude, you're really good. Like, what's your background? Do you ride mountain bikes at all? Because I was just on a dirt jumper at the time.
A little BMX or a hardtail mountain bike?
Yeah, I had actually gotten a hardtail at that point. Just like a really beater one that we kind of got used, but it was really fun. And I don't know why, but I was always drawn to like the bigger wheels for some reason. So I saw all my buddies riding BMX. And when I saw that, I was like, oh, that's cool. And then the first time I saw someone with a hardtail mountain bike, it was my best friend, Adam. I was like, dude, that is so cool. Cause it just the way it looked and everything, like I need to work towards that. So actually when I was 15, ended up getting a job, and then I'd work just, you know, after school, go straight to work, save all my pennies. And then I bought a little hardtail, and that was it. Basically I was hooked on mountain biking from that point.
Wow.
But I'd never really ridden a trail before. I'd only ridden dirt jumps and street. And then those guys kind of saw me riding. They're like, dude, you would have fun riding trails. Like, come with us. And they let me borrow a downhill bike for a day. And then remember, like, on that day when I got to go ride downhill with those guys, I remember on the trail being like, I want to spend my life doing this. Like, it was so fun. Because you're just like, I felt like I was in Star Wars, where you're just like speeding past the trees. And just, I don't know, I was such a squid too. Like, I'll just like skid and like hit trees and get up. I'd be all stoked. And I didn't even understand the concept of, like, you know, letting off the brakes or doing all these basic things, but it was so much fun.
Yeah.
And I don't know, it just completely hooked me, like, from that point on. And ever since then, you know, I kind of went to the drawing board and was like, okay, I want to do this for my life. Like, this is what I want. How do I make it happen? And then it kind of seemed like racing was really the only avenue at that point.
Okay.
So I just dove into, like, racing. I started studying a lot, like watching all the Freecaster videos and earth and dirt and all that stuff. And it was just so much fun, because I would watch Sam Hill and Menar and all these guys just shred these trails. And all I wanted to do is be like them. And that's kind of where the passion started. And yeah, after a few years, started racing downhill, and then enduro became a thing. And that was really fun too. And that's really like the path that I kind of took, because the whole goal was, how do I do this as a living? There wasn't social media at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, there wasn't really any other ways. It's like, be indoor disorder videos or race. And I was like, okay, well, I think I want to learn how to race. And that was like, all right, we're going that way. So it's kind of fun.
Where did those guys take you for that first downhill ride?
So there's like a little, it was fully illegal, but there's a little area outside of Chico, California called Pescenta. And there was these really cool forested trails, not super technical, but just really high speed and just fun, like rollers through all the pine trees. And I don't know, it was like the perfect place to get indoctrinated, because there was like no rock gardens. There was no crazy jumps. It was just fast, fun trail. I was like, dude, this is sick. So
was that a shuttle day, or did you guys
shuttle
up the trail? Shuttle day.
First time mountain biking with shuttling. I was like, this is sick. Then I learned you had to pedal too. So I was like, I need a downhill bike. And then you go through that phase of like, I want to go downhill. It's like, well, how do you get to the top? The downhill bike wasn't as functional, but
so you were working, what were you doing for a job at that point?
So I started like hunting on Craigslist, and I was, you know, obviously bitten by the bike bug. And I found this guy who was yard selling bikes. And so his name was John, and I basically went, and he paid me, you know, $8 an hour under the table to just help him fix up all these old like Nishiki road bikes and beach cruisers and stuff, and sell them to the college kids on the weekends.
Yeah.
So that was where I started. And I worked there for, I think, 6 to 8 months, and then got a job at one of the local bike shops. And then, yeah, just by the time I was 16, I got kicked out of school because I was failing. So they basically said, you're out, because I was like 0.5 GPA, and I kept ditching school to go ride. And because I was just like, I don't know, when you're at home dealing with stuff and then you wake up, you go to school, and you just are dealing with teachers being dicks, or just like just the problems that you kind of face at school. I was like, this is not what I need at the moment. I need something healing and stress relieving. So I would just say, all right, I'm going riding. And I just ditch. And it was funny, because a few of the teachers that I had could see what was happening, and they would like care and actually kind of took me under the wing. But there's a few teachers that didn't really understand that I was going through a lot. And so they would just kind of double down on like, if you're not going to be on time, or if you're going to, you know, miss too much class, like, you're out. Like, I don't want you in my class. And I always was trying to be a good kid, but, you know, just being absent so much, because I was like so stressed out that I couldn't really, I don't know, it was just so much to deal with, like trying to make sure that everything at home is okay, and then going to school, and then, you know, getting homework and tests and all these things that were happening on top of like making sure my mom didn't kill herself.
Yeah, because we were home. There's not much time to do homework when you're looking after mom, right?
Yeah, like, exactly. And then like at that point too, we were dealing with so much with like my mom being sick, depressed. We were living in an abandoned house. My brother was a meth addict. He was coming over and stealing my mom's drugs at the time. And so they were like battling. And then I'm like this 15-year-old kid who's dealing with that all night. And then basically like you're expected to go to school and perform well. And at that point, I don't know, it was just, it was so hard to, it's hard for people to understand, like, the teachers look at you and be like, don't you care about your education? And you're like, dude, I actually don't. It's like, I'm trying to survive right now. And this is the last thing that I have energy for at the moment. Like, yeah. I don't want to be here. I can't be here. I'm stressed. Like, I'm thinking about stuff. I'm hoping when I come home, my mom's still alive. Like, I don't know what's happening. You know, like, I don't give a shit about the American History 201, you know? And like, yeah. It's so hard for people to relate to that when they don't understand it. And so then what was cool about the bike is that when I was feeling like overwhelmed and stressed and like didn't have anything that I could grasp onto, then I would just like ride to the dirt jumps and I would just go play at the dirt jumps. And all the guys there, it was kind of like the band of misfits, you know? And so then we all were going through different things together, but everyone related to each other because, like, you know, my friend Nick, his mom was an addict and he was a foster kid. And my friend Dylan, his mom was an addict and his dad beat him. And like all these kids, we'd all be at the dirt jumps together in the middle of the day while school's going on. No one else is there. Yeah. And we're all just like buddies kind of hanging out and like dealing with everything.
Supporting each other.
Yeah, exactly. And like, we're best friends. We're all 15, 16 years old. We just ride all day, every day. And like, it was just, that was the first time in my life that I felt like a community that understood what was happening. And they were, no one ever asked you about what was going on at home, because it's just understood, like, all right, things are messed up, like, let's just go ride. Yeah. And having that was so cool. And I think that's something that I'm still really passionate about. And that's why, you know, a lot of times people will see like that I do try to help kids out more so, like building a pump track in my hometown of Chico, which was basically for the kids to have somewhere to go that's legal. Yeah. Because the dirt jumps we went to when I was growing up, they got torn down. So it's like, we need something. But I don't know, man, it's just hard. Because like, when you identify the bike and that community as being like your sole escape and the way that you can actually like de-stress and have positive, like positivity in your life.
Yeah.
And then you throw on top of it that like you start to get good and people recognize you and they're like, oh dude, like that's sick what you just did. Or, you know, oh, that was a sick whip. Or, oh, you just learned how to 180. That's so cool. Like, I've been wanting to learn that. And you kind of have those moments where people actually look up to you and you're like, dude, I'm just a kid trying to like figure out my life. And I don't know, it was just, it was really cool to go through that, because it gives you so much perspective on other people and other people's struggles. And I'm just glad that through my brother's downfall at that time, I was able to kind of see like, okay, I don't want to do that. I don't want to do drugs, because I was seeing how it ruined his life. And then my mom being an addict and then depressed, it's like, how do you deal with that too? So it was kind of like, you know, they say teenagers, when they get to a certain age, they rebel. And it was almost my form of rebelling to be clean.
Right. To be the opposite to what you were so used to seeing around.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, all right, well, if you guys are just going to be messed up, then I'm just going to be clean. Like, and I never smoked. I never drank, never did anything growing up. Like, it was just, I'm going to be clean. And that's my way of basically, you know, kind of telling my family, like, F you, like, I'm going to actually make it out of this. And so that was why it was so cool, because the bike was that thing that I got addicted to that was positive instead of getting addicted to something negative.
Yeah.
But
that's incredible, man. I was going to ask you how you avoided falling into those traps, and that's it.
Yeah.
Like, you already answered it.
It's like
pretty incredible.
It's just disgusting to see your family fall apart and like constantly just have issues over and over and over and over again. And you just see the same pitfalls over and over again. And like, I don't know, it's just so frustrating seeing that and being in it for so long that like the exact opposite of that is what you strive for. So you're like, I'm going to do the exact opposite. So I'm going to learn how to manage things. I'm not going to like be an addict. I'm not going to be, but I know some people, they can't escape that and they fall into it. Right. But I think that's why bikes are so cool, because it gave me enough like confidence and it gave me the ability to have other people look in and see that you're like shining a little bit. Cause it's hard for a lot of people. If you don't ever do anything sports wise or have any of those achievements, like now kids have gaming where they can get really good at gaming.
Right.
And that's really cool. Like, I'm a huge fan of the fact that kids can like become an awesome gamer and then they can get recognition through their peer group through that. But I mean, you think about all the kids in high school that play football, you know, people are like, oh dude, you're so rad. Like, oh, he's one of the jocks. Like, everyone looks up to him.
Yeah.
But for most kids struggling that don't have anything to attach their identity to, that's when you get in trouble. Cause it's like, they don't have that kind of stable anchor point. And that's kind of what bikes became, was almost that anchor where it's like, I could anchor my identity to how good I was on a bike.
Right.
And then the better I got at biking, the stronger that anchor got. And so it's like, I became more and more confident in myself as I got better. And then it just feels that fire of like, okay, you can do this. You can be a pro. I know you can make this happen. Like, just keep working. And the better you get, the stronger this will be. So kind of made you feel like you're floating less in life. And that was really impactful, because I felt like what a big part of what my mom's problem was, and my brother's at the time too, was like, they didn't have that anchor. So they're just kind of like, what is the meaning of life? Just floating through things and not really having a directive or direction that they're going. Mm-hmm. So it's hard to, it's almost like if you're on a road trip and you never knew where you were going to stop, you know, and they're like, yeah. Well, how much longer are we driving? It's like, dude, I have no idea. You know, like, it could be a minute, it could be an hour, it could be 10 hours, but without direction, it's like some people are optimistic and some people are pessimistic. And so the people that struggle with pessimism, they will kind of assume the worst. And then like my mom, anytime things got rough, she didn't have a direction of like a goal where we're going. So it's like, yo, this is it. Like, it just fell apart, you know?
Yeah. But that's really insightful. Were you aware of that at that age, or is this sort of reflecting back on that time that you see these kind of things?
I think subconsciously I was aware of it. And, you know, I think what, I know it's interesting. Like, I read a lot of books and they say 90% or, you know, whatever the real number is, 80 and 90% of your processing power is subconscious. And then your conscious thought is like 10 or 15, 20%. And I think that subconsciously I was able to identify, you know, these are key issues that are I'm seeing with these people, like with my mom and my brother at the time. There's no directive. They don't have anything to look forward to. Cause if you don't know where you're going, how do you look forward to anything?
Yeah. Yeah.
You know? And so it's like, then the best thing they could do is just get high that day, because then they look forward to getting high. And then it's like, you just repeat, repeat, repeat. So that's what's cool with like, with biking, especially, is when I see kids that are like at the skate park alone, you know, they bring their backpack, you know, if a kid has a backpack at the skate park, they're there for a while. Yeah. So it's like, anytime you see a kid there, I'll just go up to him and be like, dude, like, you're shredding. It's so sick. Are you going to try to go pro? Or have you thought about that at all? And a lot of times they'll like light a fire. Like, I never thought about that. And that kind of, even just that little thought of like, I'm going to try to be pro. Like, that was my goal. And so that's what everything filtered through, that goal.
Yeah.
Whereas a lot of kids that don't have that, they're just like, I don't know, I'm just floating, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So, they've got the bike, but they don't have any goals from it or anything.
Yeah, exactly. And I don't know, even this year, like with the YouTube stuff we've done, one of the coolest things about the whole experience has been some of the mentors that I've met through, like, they've watched the videos, they've reached out personally. And one of the guys, he's like a really successful businessman. His name's John. And talking to him, he kind of said something that was insightful to me. And he said, if you don't have a path for your business to be the best, like in its field, if you don't have the path to be number one at what you do, then you'll fail. At some point, you know? So he's like, whatever you do, look forward and set the path up of how you could be number one. So say it's on, you know, like YouTube, for example, it's like, how do you get to be the number one channel? How do you get to do this? Like, whatever your niche is. And I thought about that. I'm like, man, I guess that's what I did with biking. It's like, my goal was to be national champion and then world champion. And then, you know, that was it. Like, that's what I want to go. It wasn't like, I want to be a mid pack. You know, it's like,
here's, it'll be okay.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, how do you got to set the goal to be the best. And then if you stray from that, you'll still end up where you kind of want to go, you know, like, cause it's hard to achieve exactly what you desire, but if you at least set it in that direction, then you'll end up somewhere on that chain.
But that brings its own challenges though too, right? In the sense that, how do you deal with not getting to those goals, like not getting to world champion downhill or whatever it is, right?
Yep.
How do you deal with those?
Yeah, I know that was interesting. Like, for me, what was kind of cool is the goal that I'd set out at first was like, I wanted to be a national champion. And that was like the thing, right? So I did the North American Enduro Series. And then when I got that first championship there, that was like a huge goal. Then the next goal was like repeat and become a World Cup EWS regular. So then I got the second championship the next year and then started to race quite a bit. Like, you know, had plans in place to do the EWS.
Yeah.
And then that fall, so that October, I think I won the championship in September. That October, we opened the public pump track that I had worked on the whole year prior in Chico. And at that grand opening day, I remember seeing all the kids smiling. I remember seeing the parents out there. I remember seeing all of my friends that I grew up with that were kind of those misfit kids.
Right.
There riding. And I said, okay, my goal, okay, new goal. Like, that one, the old one doesn't matter. I don't care about winning. Like, this is so much more fulfilling, right. And it's like help more people. And that was the change. So your goals can evolve, but it's like, I don't know. That was the original goal, was do championship for myself. That's a selfish pursuit. And then as soon as I saw how much you could impact other people, then I was like, okay, new goal. Like, let's go this way. Cause I mean, winning and doing all these things for yourself, it doesn't really bring a lot of happiness or fulfillment in the same way, right. I think. Whereas, you know, every time when I was still living in Chico and I would ride past the pump track or drive past the pump track at like 7 o'clock at night, and there's a couple kids like straggling there that are riding and doing laps and like learning how to get better when they should be at home with their family, then that was like, okay, that was me, you know, when I was a kid. So it's like, how do you do things that give back to those people instead of just, if I won a world championship, it's like, yeah, cool. You know, like it doesn't really do anything, you know?
Yeah. So it's almost, I think it was Stephanie Gilmore, who's like a multiple world championship winning surfer. She said something along the same lines where she's won all these championships, but they don't really fulfill her in the same way that she thought they would. Mm-hmm. She feels like that what should be done is the platform she's built from that is then turning that around and helping others, which is kind of what you're doing as well. Like, you've built a name for yourself from racing, and now you're flipping that and helping others to get a joy out of bikes.
Yeah, totally. And I think that that's definitely what is way more fulfilling. And I think it's hard because a lot of the times, you know, like the externality or the external motivation that people put on things. Because for me, my goal originally was like, make biking my life. That's mm-hmm. what I wanted, number one. And so then it's like I said, at that point, social media wasn't around and I wasn't a free rider. So it's kind of like, okay, the best thing I can do is race. And then what does that mean to be successful at racing? It means national championship, world championship. And so that was like the path I was on. But at the end of the day, I didn't see this bigger opportunity that helping other people find biking could also create this life of being involved with bikes too. And once I saw that like, all the people at the pump track were so happy. And then a lot of the sponsors, like Marin was my sponsor at that time. They actually drove from California, like Novato, out to Chico to be a part of it. And they got to hold like a little demo event that day. And I could just see it in like the CEO, Matt, in his face, how happy he was and how proud he was that like one of his athletes did this. And, you know, it was like, he helped support this. And at that moment, I was like, man, companies don't care about racing a lot of times, like not all. What they care about is you being a good ambassador for the sport and to help get more people into it and grow the pie. And, you know, it's like, that's what they actually care about. And once I identified that, it's like, dude, you can literally do anything you want and still be a part of the bike industry as long as you're contributing to it. So it's like, I don't know, it's cool. It's like the more you give to it, the more it gives back to you. And it's like this really cool reciprocal relationship. Whereas if you just get in and you're like, sponsor me, pay me money, pay for my expenses, pay for my trips, and then I'm going to win you a championship, then like you're not going to get as much out of it as if you give back to it.
Right. It sounds like the Chico pump track was a pretty big point in your career so far.
Yeah, it was a big life achievement. Like it was cool because no one had ever done anything like that where it's a public free pump track in our area. And I had to fight city council for it. I had to go to all these meetings and like just this big process. And I actually won like the community involvement award that year from the city of Chico. Wow. Like, so that was really cool. And I don't know, like I have that next to like out on display, actually, not any of my trophies. So it's like, I don't know. It was really cool. Cause it's directly impacting people's lives. And I'm definitely really empathetic to kids that are struggling because I saw so many of my friends, you know, like my friend Nick and my friend Dylan. Nick became an addict, went to prison. My friend Dylan became an addict, went to prison. And it's like the kids that I were with, even though we all had the same goal of biking, because they weren't able to like, honestly, a lot of it is because they were on a BMX bike instead of a mountain bike. And the BMX industry didn't have the same kind of like onboarding process of development, where like in BMX, if you're not a top pro guy that's making video parts, there's not like a development series. Whereas with mountain biking, I got to be a junior expert, race at a junior expert level, and then go to pro and then be a mid pack pro and then get support and then be like top pro. So I got kind of funneled through, and they don't really
have those goals set along the way for you almost.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, okay, how do I be pro? Okay, well, you need to be a top junior X guy. Then you'll get, you know, offers from people, and you have those little baby steps. And in BMX, it's like, how do you go pro as a, you know, street rider,
yeah,
like just be the baddest dude. And you're like, okay,
put how out do I banger video clips.
Yeah. So a lot of those kids were really talented, but they didn't have the same ability to like check off those baby steps.
Right.
But I don't know. It just made me sad because you see how much talent and drive and I don't know, like they're so willing to do that. If there was someone in their life that just said, here's the steps, follow these, then they would have been able to figure it out. But because it was open-ended, they got lost and then they just kind of lost that anchor.
Yeah, I totally understand what you're going through there. I had a friend growing up who, he was the younger brother of my best mate, but we were all best mates because we hung out 24/7. And he was the same sort of thing where he was crazy talented like your friends, and he could surf really well. He could skateboard really well. He could have been pro in any of them. And he was beating a lot of the guys who are still professional surfers now. But he fell into drugs and became an addict, and he's not in jail or anything, but he's got mental health issues, and it all just went out the window. It's like, man, like what, and you know, you grow up with these people, you're like, what could I have done differently to maybe help that person? But you just don't know. Like you're a kid. You have no idea what you're going through.
And it's hard too, because like what I've learned is that without someone's internal motivation to change something or to get something done, right, it's so hard to like, you can't really motivate people. You can give them opportunities and like you can give them these pathways, but even if you filter things through a few layers of difficulty, so like even if you run a giveaway, right, and you say, hey, click this link to enter the giveaway, or if it says go to this website or email this place, then like the amount of entries gets cut in half.
Totally.
So it's like the more layers you add, the more it filters things out. And I was listening to this guy Gary Vaynerchuk, you know, Gary V, and he's like a business mindset entrepreneur guy. And they asked him, why do you give out all of these tips and, you know, all of this, these secrets? He goes, well, cause I know no one's going to actually do it. Like it takes effort, you know?
Yeah.
He said, and for the people that do actually take these tips and advice and make something of themselves, like I'm proud of them. So he said, I know that by me putting this out, if it gets 1 million views, maybe 2 or 3 people will actually do it.
Wow.
So he's like, and I'm happy for those 2 or 3 people, you know? So it's, I don't know, it's just weird. Like
they're not like giving it out for free. He's not losing his skin off his back or anything. Like,
no, not at all. Cause not, I mean, that's what's so cool about YouTube right now is that like anyone who wants to have a life in biking could theoretically start a YouTube channel and try to give back to the community and have it be a valuable thing that like the industry would reward.
Yeah.
And the only real barrier for entry is your effort.
Right.
So it's like, do you want to sit and edit 20 hours a week? And a lot of people say, well, I want to have a life in the industry, but no, I don't want to sit in front of a computer that long. It's like, well, okay, then you're out. You know, so it's like, it's really funny, but that's kind of, I was talking to a different, you know, Paul the Punter, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Paul. We were just talking about that. And it's like, what is the barrier for entry with YouTube? And some people say it's camera gear or this, that.
Right.
It's like, it's not, it's effort, you know? Like, do you want to try hard enough to actually build it and put all these videos together consistently and make something cool? Or does it take too much work and you're just kind of happy riding around, you know? So it's cool.
Yeah, pretty much everyone has a, well, it's hard to say there are people who don't, but cameras can be obtained and most people have a phone with a camera on it and all that kind of stuff. Right.
Yeah. So. And there's people that have, you know, 1 million subscribers that use iPhone.
Yeah.
So it's like, camera equipment and all those things do definitely help, but there is this base, you know, opportunity that's available where like, if I was a kid and I was in that same position where bikes were my goal, like that's what I wanted to do for my life. And if they just told me, hey, if you just start filming like these fun videos that are helpful for people, then you can make this happen. I would have been on it, you know, like whatever it takes, that's what I'm doing that. So it's cool that there's all these kids that see that now and that have the opportunity. And it's going to be really fun to see where the industry can go, because as it keeps growing, it like just keeps bringing in more and more people that need this outlet. So it's, I know there's a lot of controversy too about like over usage on trails and the sport growing, but at the end of the day, if you think about it as like one of the most positive mental health outlets for people, then it's kind of like, okay, so what are we really complaining about? We're complaining that more people are getting help than ever, right? Like more people more people are getting access to bikes. They're like, how's that bad? You know,
if you got into it because you wanted to do something unique that no one else is doing, then maybe that's the wrong reason to have gotten into it. Or yeah. You need to maybe reassess why, what the real reason was, because it was probably more to do with a break, like me as well, like just having that time away and disconnecting, I guess, from the real world.
Yeah, I know. It's just cool to see the industry growing and getting exposure, and like, you know, almost every other car commercial you see now, there's a mountain bike on.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like, it's just cool. Cause when I was growing up and my mom heard me talk about it, like, you know, what are you doing? You know, she didn't even understand. And it's like, so you just go ride around into the dirt. Like what is that? So it's cool that it's becoming, more understood. I think it's getting a lot more acceptance, but
I don't want to say, I've heard people refer to it as the modern day golf, but there's arguments against that. But in the sense that it's not a sort of niche activity that you do illegally in the forest behind your parents' place anymore. It's like, it's a family activity and stuff like that.
Yeah, I know. It's been really cool. So I don't know. I'm all for it as far as like, if it can help people and if it can get people outside and being positive, then it's like, I don't know, just bring it on. Like, let's do this together and let's make something cool happen, because that's like the number one issue that society faces at the moment is mental health issues. And a lot of it comes from lack of feeling of purpose. Like, a lot of people don't feel like they have purpose and they don't understand what their role is in life. And if you can get on a bike, and for a small percentage of people, if that can turn into your purpose of like helping other people get on a bike, then it gives you a lot of directive towards what to do next, you know? Like, and obviously with what you're doing too, it's, you want to get people stoked on bikes and get people knowledgeable and get them out riding, because however it's positively impacted your life. And I think that you'll see that with people like Seth's Bike Hacks, who has a huge YouTube channel. Like, he just wants to get people stoked on it. And what's great about him is you don't have to be a mountain biker to watch his videos and get a kick out of them. So it's bringing in all these people that were never a part of it. You know, like pinkbike.com, their average article gets about 38,000 views. And like Seth's Bike Hacks, his average video gets 1 million views.
No way.
Yeah. So it's like, like, we all think about Pink Bike or these other websites being kind of the filter that everyone views mountain biking through. But in reality, like, it's less than 1/30th the size of Seth's Bike Hacks.
Of one person's YouTube account.
Yeah, exactly. So it's like, imagine if you were to affect one person on Pink Bike, or you could affect 30 people that don't know anything about mountain bikes over here and help them get into the sport. Like, there's a lot of opportunity to grow things on that other side. So that's what's been really cool. I don't know. I get a kick out of that, because it just is fun getting people that see the videos and go, dude, that looks so fun. And now I understand how to do it better. And like, I want to rent a bike and this looks cool. I want to be a part of it. And so that gets me stoked.
Let's get into that. Like, your YouTube channel is something you've been doing for a while, actually. Like, I had a look through today and you've been doing videos on there forever. And even the tech, like, educational videos.
Yeah.
I think there was one there that dated 2 years back. So
yep.
It's not something fully new to you, but obviously there's been more of a focus on it the last few years.
Yeah, it's been like, I was actually at Sea Otter Classic in, I think, 2018 or 17. I think it was 18. And they had a line where it was like, get your jersey signed, or, you know, get a poster signed by Aaron Gwynn. And then there was like maybe 8 to 10 people in that line. And then there was a line that said, meet Seth's Bike Hacks. And there was like 300 people lining around.
No way.
Yeah, it was so funny. And I was kind of like, I don't know, just with what I talked about earlier.
Aaron Gwynn signing was at the Pink Bike booth, right?
Yeah, I think so. Or the TLD one. Or something. Yeah, yeah. I was like, man, this is so crazy. Like, this dude is the fastest guy in the world. And then this guy has a YouTube channel. And I didn't know anything about it at that point. But I know a lot of people would say, oh, that's lame. And for the way I always think about it is, if other people are attracted to it, then like, what's going on? Like, let's investigate. Mm-hmm. And then I started to kind of watch, and I'm like, dude, this is so cool. Like, he is reaching these people in a different way. And that's why they want to meet him, is they feel like his friend. Whereas, you know, I'm sure those 300 people probably knew who Aaron Gwynn was, but they might not feel like they could approach him.
Right.
Cause they're like, he's on a pedestal, and Seth is like their buddy that makes videos. And
well, they can relate to him a bit more too, right?
Yeah, totally. And so when I saw that, it kind of got the wheels turning of, all right, I think that this could be cool, because like we talked about the pump track, like, I want to help people get onto bikes. It seems like this avenue is really good for just reaching a ton of people and engaging with them. And that kind of, I was like, okay, I need to learn how to do this. So I went back, and then you could see like in those earlier videos, I was learning, I didn't know what a camera, how it worked. I didn't know about audio. I didn't know about lighting or anything. So I'm like, all right, well, I'll start putting some time in. And then, yeah, it took about a year and a half to 2 years of just learning things. And then this past May, kind of just fully invested in a camera setup. And then we just said, all right, we're going for it. And then since May, we grew from like 4,000 subscribers to 200,000. So that's been, it was really crazy year, but it was, a lot of people were like, oh, you got lucky. But it's kind of like, no, I worked at it for 2 years to figure out what, right, what fits. And then, okay, like, let's do it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, like, I think for someone like you, you would agree that luck doesn't really play a big role in it. It's more about drive and motivation.
Yeah, yeah, it's definitely effort and just being kind of shedding your ego a little bit too of, you know, a lot of the people that came from racing, when they started hearing about YouTube, they're like, oh, that is so lame. Like, I will never be associated with that. That is stupid, blah, blah, like just talking so much crap on it. But they didn't actually understand, like, who's watching YouTube and what is that audience? And it's so different because you can do something like that might get a ton of views on Pink Bike, and then you put that same video and host it on YouTube and it gets no views. Or you could do vice versa where people don't care about it on Pink Bike because it's not core, but it reaches a ton of people on YouTube. So I don't know. It's just understanding who the demographic is. And like on our YouTube channel, I think 60% of our audience is over the age of 40.
Wow.
So it's like a lot of people, like 40 to 66 years old. There's a ton of people there. And then on Instagram, my audience was 80% under the age of 24. So it's like, you know, who are you making videos for? And that was something that I really started to understand. And then we have the rest of that, like 40%. A lot of it is kind of that mid-range people. And we don't have a ton of kids, but we do have a lot of families that watch. And so there is like those kids within that, that 40-year-old group, because that's the families watching together. So
yeah,
I don't know, it's cool.
Do you think a lot of that core demographic on your channel is I guess middle-aged, or some of them going beyond middle-aged, people who are just getting into the sport and they want to, they've reached you because they've heard, or you come up in their feed and the instructional piece of it seems to be something that fits for them?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is people that kind of just have been forgotten by the industry. You know, it's like, who do most bike magazines and who do most websites market to? And if you look at it,
it's that core user who already knows how to do so much.
Yeah, exactly. And then how does someone, like if you were to get into rock climbing right now or something, like where would you go to find out how to do stuff? You'd probably go to YouTube because you feel welcome there, right? Like, so I don't know. It's just kind of those people that were a little bit forgotten by the industry, but there are some other great YouTube channels out there. And then we kind of just were another addition to that of like, hey, this is really cool. And so it's kind of nice because in the YouTube community, it's not like if someone else good pops up, it takes away from you. It's, hey, there's all these cool videos out here. And if you do a good video on it, it might inspire someone else to do a good video on it, which then like, I don't even care. Cause if we started to do how-to videos on stuff and then other channels would try to copy the same video or formula.
Yeah.
Then it's cool because then it just gets more views on people that it like helps people.
Yeah.
So we had that happen a few times where we'd post a video and then like 2 to 3 weeks later, a big website would kind of copy the same video and post it. And then it was funny because it would get views, but that's cool because I would look at it as like, oh, we impacted this other large audience through inspiring this company to do that, you know?
Yeah.
So I don't know. It's just really cool. Like it's been fun. And I feel like if you can just view it as like, the more people you impact and help, the more the industry will give back to you type thing. So our goal is just help people get inspired to help people.
Nice. Would you say that your move to educational videos was conscious then?
Yeah. And a lot of it was because of my girlfriend, April. She came from a motocross background and then she's wanted to learn how to mountain bike quite a bit, but I'm usually gone all summer. And so it's kind of hard because I'll be gone most of the riding season, racing, traveling, doing events. And then I come home and then we have a few weeks of riding together and then the weather gets kind of bad. So with COVID happening, she's like, hey, this is our chance. Like, I want to learn to mountain bike. And I'm like, well, I'm definitely going to be home this summer. So like, let's make it happen. And yeah, it was really fun. It was, she inspired a lot of it, honestly, because she was saying, hey, I want to try to learn this stuff. It'd be cool. Maybe we could film you teaching me it. And then we did a few of them and it started to take off. And then we're like, oh man, this is really cool. People are enjoying it. And so now we're kind of still following that same arc, but trying to add in some other little pieces here and there. And like I said earlier, before the podcast started, we're trying to just scale things to be like more sustainable in the future. So right. I would eventually love for it to not only have to be just April and I, like if we could bring other people in and, like I said, just give back more. Cause if we're only capable together of doing one or two videos a week, right. and that's a lot of work. If we could yeah. bring more people in and do more, then that would be awesome.
Cool. Plans to expand.
Yeah, exactly. Like I think a lot of times, you have to do it the right way, obviously, cause people trust you. Right. And right. so it's like, yeah. if you just bring on random people, then it's maybe not the best, but we have some plans on how to kind of do that over the next couple of years. And the goal would be to just be able to put out more good content. So cool. yeah, even if it ends up where maybe we have someone who handles some tech videos and someone who handles other things, like, and then we handle what we do, then it could be cool just to add more components together.
Right. Talking about your sort of audience, I guess, and April being a large part of it, have you seen a lot of female interest in the channel as well?
Yeah, that's been something that's really cool too, because like on Instagram, originally my female percentage was 1% female, 99% right. male, like 98.9% male. And with YouTube and with April being a part of it, that channel, which originally started as like my channel and then it morphed into April and I's channel, it went from 1% to like 15 or 20% female. Wow. So massive female.
In the last 8 months or whatever.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And if you think about that, like 15% or 20% of 200,000, that's like 30 or 40,000 women.
Yeah.
So it's really cool.
It's unreal.
Yeah. And it's like to think about the fact that there's 30 or 40,000 women who have found the videos helpful enough to where they would subscribe to our channel. I think that's really cool. And that was amazing. And April loves hearing the stories of girls seeing that. And it's nice because like, I think a lot of times women's content, maybe they'll try to like, I don't know, they'll try to simplify it sometimes too much, right? If it's trying to be like a women's content piece, you're like, no, just teach it the same way. If you teach right. someone good technique, then it doesn't matter if you're male or female, like you'll,
yeah.
you can execute it.
You don't need to
it.
Dumb it down because they're another sex.
Yeah, exactly. And so I thought that was really cool. And then, I don't know, it's just been... It's been so eye-opening, honestly. Like, I feel like I've learned so much, and April's learned so much this year, just who is out there riding mountain bikes and what they look like, what they act like, what they talk about, what is important to them. And it's so different than what you would think if you just read Pink Bike or, yeah. you know, a different website. It's like, I don't know, it's just not everyone is just all about shredding, but there's so many people. Like, we had a couple message us, and they said, thank you guys so much for what you've done. My wife and I have been struggling for the past year or so with our relationship and our marriage.
Right.
And I've always wanted her to get into mountain biking, but she's been afraid. And she found your channel, she started watching, and she actually began mountain biking, and now she loves it. And we have a shared passion, and it saved our marriage.
Yeah.
And so
that's unreal.
Yeah. It's like, and you think about that, and then you multiply that by like the reach, and it's like, oh my God, there's so many people that are getting impacted. And the fact that we can be a small part of that is so cool.
Mm-hmm.
And it makes me feel so much happier and more fulfilled than just like posting an Instagram banger and then
or stepping on top of a podium. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. That was cool. And like, even not even on the relationship side, but we had a guy email us like a really heartfelt message through COVID just saying, hey, I live in the UK. Like, I've been super depressed this past year with everything going on, and I didn't know what to do. And like, I was contemplating killing myself. And then I started watching your guys' videos, and like the way that you and April treat each other and the way that she smiles at you. And like, it got me into mountain biking, and I wanted to tell you, thank you, because you guys helped me get through this. So,
wow.
Yeah. Stuff like that. Like, how does
someone like that even stumble across or click play on a video that's bike related when they're not into bikes? That's wild.
That's what's cool about YouTube is that most of the views, like a lot of people say, oh, you need to figure out the algorithm. And really at the end of the day, all the algorithm is did you make a good video? Are right. people watching a large percentage of the video? And are they clicking like or subscribe afterwards? And if you can get something that people are watching a large percentage of it and they enjoy it and they share it with their friends, then YouTube will just start sharing it. So we had a video go kind of like not viral, but semi-viral 2 weeks ago or 3 weeks ago where we rode at Ray's Mount Bike Park.
Right.
And it got like 1.3 million views in a week. But
wow,
what's crazy is that 88% of those views came from YouTube suggesting it to random people.
Really?
Yeah. Only like, huh. I think only it said 3% of it was from other websites and my social media and other people's social media is like sharing it.
Wow.
So it's like over 80%.
I wonder almost what it was about that video that YouTube felt it needed to push it so much.
I think it was because a large demographic, even people that were not mountain bikers, would watch it. And they started to see like, oh man, okay, we test it in this mountain bike demographic. It does pretty well. We test it in this demographic. Oh, these people like it too. Okay, let's test it here. And, you know, they just kind of start sharing it. And then you have these moments where it like has virality and it's because anyone could enjoy it. And it's just like a short little cool video that anyone can enjoy, even if they don't like mountain biking. So that stuff's cool, but that's, I guess YouTube.
You guys have, I do watch quite a few of your videos and that's how I thought, hey, I should reach out to Kyle. Like, this is awesome. But you guys have like a really good charismatic relationship on camera.
Mm-hmm.
And even April, I know she was a bit shy of the camera initially, but that added authenticity to it and people could relate to it so much more.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's different to everyone else. Like a lot of the guys on camera, you say like put your ego aside, but they're still, you know, cocky and confident and all this kind of thing. But you guys are really soft and just heartfelt. It seems really honest and true.
Thank
so
you.
People are into it more.
Yeah, I feel like that's just because I'm so shy with camera stuff, you know, like, and April is as well. And for us to do this stuff, it took so much energy to be like, all right, I think we can do it. Like, okay, come on. And I don't know, it's just, but once you start to see that it's helping people, then it's like, okay, no matter how uncomfortable and awkward I feel, then like we got to do it because right. It's helping people. So like, let's make it happen. But
that's
yeah,
awesome.
I don't know. It's been so cool to watch April come out of her shell too, just with that and just gain the confidence and know that she's making an impact with all these people. Because I feel like a lot of times in girls, like in women's life, it's hard for them to get appreciated in the same way as other people are, right? And so it's like, she's getting appreciated for being authentic and being herself and trying really hard and learning these new things. And it's like, people are genuinely saying like, we appreciate you for who you are, not just like what you did or what you look like. Or
yeah,
so I don't know, it's really cool. And then a little kid the other day asked, he goes, is it weird that people know you? And I was like, I don't know, I feel like racing helped a lot with that.
Yeah.
Because you kind of start to get known in the smaller community, but since it's still such a small community, you know, like if you go to the pizza shop, no one knows who you are, but then every once in a while you go to like a bike event, everyone's like, oh my God, I know who that is, you know?
Yeah.
So it's like this weird thing. And then now with YouTube, it's like wherever you go, people kind of know you, but it's almost like we got so used to just not being known all the time that it's like, it doesn't have that same ego feel.
Right.
You know, like a lot of people that get kind of noticed for the first time, they're like, oh yeah, I'm important. And
yeah.
For us, it's like, oh no, we're just two kooks trying to figure it out still. But I don't know. It's embarrassing almost sometimes, like, oh, but
yeah,
I don't know.
I'd be terrible at dealing with people recognizing me. Yeah, stay away from it.
It's cool though. I'm just glad it helps people.
With all the chatter about April and the success of the content that includes her with women specifically, is there any goal or ambition to create more female specific pieces with her on the channel?
Yeah, I think that she has a few outlined. So the other night we sat down and just said, like, what videos would you want to do this year that are kind of yours, like take initiative on it. And she wants to do a few things that are more women specific, cool. As far as like gear and things like that. But we've also kind of found, like we talked about earlier, that a lot of times when they try to do things that are too women specific, it almost like takes away. Cause it's like if you provide valuable information, you can do it in a way where it applies to both parties.
Right.
So we're trying to figure that out. And I mean, we're not perfect or anything by any means. It's just like, we're learning a lot. And there's been a few things we've done where people are like, hey, I like that. And a few things where people are like, hey, you know, I didn't like that as much. So just trying to figure it out. But yeah, I think it would be really cool to, do some more like women's camps and like kind of retreats and things like that in the future, where they could do like a weekend and people could come together. And we did that. We went out to Cleveland, Ohio for that Rays mountain bike park, and that was for a women's weekend. So April got to help coach, and I helped coach a lot of the women there, but it was really cool just because like a lot of the girls, they want to get treated exactly like the guy, and they want to learn the same exact information, and they want to be respected. And you're like, okay, let's do it. I'm like, yeah, it's like sweet. And a lot of the women are really great riders. And what I've noticed about a lot of the women is they listen much better than a lot of the guys. And so what's interesting is you can tell them, hey, pay attention to this, this, and this. And they go, okay, I got it. You know, whereas a lot of the guys, you'll have to keep fighting. I'm like, hey, you're doing good, but try to keep paying attention to this. Like, keep talking about it, but just pay attention to your heel, you know? And the girls are like, nope, okay, got it. So it's been cool.
I can relate to that. Like, I've seen it. I used to coach snowboarding, and I've seen it on the hills for sure. Like, the men, it's almost like the testosterone or the ego gets in the way of actually taking it as helpful information.
Yeah.
The female audience is like, no, I want to learn how to do this, so I'm going to sit here and listen.
Yeah.
There's no ego.
It's so cool. I love interacting with women in that way. It's just like so cool because, yeah, they're very receptive. And I think that a lot of it is a lot of guys are kind of waiting to talk. Like, you'll give them a talking point or a piece of advice. They go, oh yeah, well, you know, you're like, hey, try to drop your heel. Oh, well, I crashed and then my ankle, you know, and it's like, well, hey, I'm not telling you that, you know, I'm just saying to keep an eye on it. And then the girls are like, okay, cool. I'm down. So like, I want to get better. So it's been really cool.
As another thing with the YouTube channel, I guess I didn't notice it, but I heard you talking about it in a recent, I think it was one of your live streamers, is you don't use much monetization on your ads.
Yeah. Why
is that? Isn't that how you make your money?
Yeah. Like, yes and no. And I don't know, it's funny. Some of the other guys, like Paul, I talked to him about this a while the other day, and he goes, you're an idiot. And I'm like, I know. But for me, like I said, the goal is to help people, right? And so the way I think about it is if we're going to be producing content that is knowledge-based or like, you know, educational-based, if you are in the middle of someone telling you something and then all of a sudden like the Kool-Aid guy jumps through the wall and is like, hey, buy Kool-Aid, you know, and then jumps out, you're like, what the hell is that? You know, so for me, it's like, let's just turn the ads off in the middle. We don't use mid-roll ads. And a lot of times people don't realize that you like creators can control that. So when you post a video, if it's over 8 minutes long, then you can go through and you can put as many ads as you want, wherever you want in the video. So you can move them around and everything and kind of break it up. And yeah, you get paid by the ads shown to people. But I felt like it's better to just avoid that and just have people have a positive experience start to finish. And then they watch the whole video and they go, that was helpful. You know, I appreciate that. I'll give you a like or a subscribe, and that kind of helps things grow, or they just have a better experience in general. And then next time we post a video, then they're more likely to come back. Because
totally,
I hate, especially if someone, say we do a video where it's like how to wheelie, and then they watch the whole thing once and then they come back again to watch like one part of it. If they have to watch an ad at the beginning of the video and then they skip ahead too far, then they would have to watch another ad to get to the part they want to listen to.
Yeah.
So it's like, dude, just get rid of that. Like, you know, just be, I don't know. I don't care about the money on that side of it that much. Like, that's not really the goal. The goal isn't financial. Like, we're fine. We're stable financially as far as like enough to live on and stuff. And then like, I just would rather have people have a better experience.
I wonder how much of that's helped with the increase in subscriptions and viewership.
Yeah, it's hard. Like, I'll talk to some people and they'll be like, you're an idiot, you're just wasting money. And then I'll talk to other people that are like, no, I really appreciate that, and it helps me watch the videos.
Yeah.
So for me, I feel like might as well just be different a little bit, you know? And if we posted a video and someone else posted the same video, and then people know that with ours, they're not going to get ads, like maybe they'll click on ours.
They'll watch yours, yeah.
Yeah. So I don't know. And that's the one really cool thing about where the industry is going now is, before, a lot of the YouTubers had to rely completely on YouTube AdSense revenue, like, because Google owns YouTube. Google is who actually pays you, because they negotiate deals with these big advertisers. The ads get shown on your video and then you get half and Google gets half. So if Coca-Cola has an ad on your video, Coke pays Google, Google takes half, they give you half. Mm-hmm. And so that was kind of how it worked forever. And a lot of the people couldn't get sponsorship from the industry because it was seen as like not big enough or not important enough. And now with what we've been able to do, like the brands that we partner with, Niner and Sun Tour and Stans and Shimano and all these great brands, they just said, hey, we've seen a lot of people that are really stoked on this. And we get emails all the time telling us, thank you for sponsoring Kyle and April.
Oh, wow.
So like that's been huge. And I don't know, that made it to where we can get sponsored and then not have to make people sit through the ads, like get the money from the brands because they're indirectly, like we're on their bikes and we're on that. So like we monetize there instead of with ads. And
people want to support the brands that are supporting you because they want to support you as well.
Yeah.
Right? Like it's all this one circle.
Yeah. It's like I said earlier, the more that you put out value, the more it'll come back to you, I feel like. So, because I mean, if you've watched some of our stuff, like you probably, I mean, we don't try to push stuff like, hey, buy this tire and buy this bike. It's like, none of that is really our goal. Our goal is like, just get people excited. And if they ask in the comments and they say, hey, what tires are you guys running? It's like, oh, I run, you know, the Magic Mary and the Knobby Nick. And they're like, sick, done, you know? So it's really cool.
So with that said, you don't have affiliate links in your descriptions either?
We will do affiliate links, but a lot of times, like a lot of what we do daily is just responding to comments too. And a lot of times people, especially on mobile device, they won't see the description very easily. You have to know where to click. So yeah, we try to field that. But just with one of our affiliate links last year, we sold $170,000 in gear.
Wow.
So it's like, you know, when you come to a sponsor and you say, hey, look, we sold you guys $170,000 in gear through our channel and through our affiliate link, like, please help support us. Then they say, yes, we'll do that.
Yeah, for sure. Because they can directly relate that to where it came from easily too. And that's a lot. That's impressive.
Yeah. And that was just for one brand. So it's like, it's really cool to see the power of YouTube. And I think honestly, what it is the power of helping people and like not expecting a whole lot in return. Like the only thing we ask for is if you guys enjoyed the video and you could like it, that helps it get seen by more people. And if you subscribe, that would be great. Like,
yeah.
Because subscription, like I feel like the subscribers right now is almost like the currency that we can use to negotiate with brands. And so that's a way people can help us is if they subscribe, it gives us more leverage to negotiate with brands, which then makes the channel better. And then if they like it, then it helps it get seen by more people.
Right. When do you get the play buttons?
100,000 and then at 1 million.
So you have a play button.
Yeah. Yeah. We got one.
That's
of them.
Awesome.
Yeah. It was cool. But I don't know. I'm excited, man. It's really cool. Cause I feel like for the first time in my life, we're in a place where we're helping a lot of people. We're doing something really fun and cool. And it's not directly attributed to like how much physical risk I'm willing to take, you know, whereas with racing, it was like, do you want to win? Okay. Are you willing to die? Yes or no? You know, it's like, okay. So now the real equation is like, you want to help people. You want to grow this channel. You want to be successful. Are you willing to put in the time editing? And it's like, yes, no. So that's been really cool. Cause it's like, we spend so much time on every video, but it's just,
so you guys film and edit everything yourselves?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So film, so like storyboard usually is the first thing. We'll storyboard, get an idea of how it'll kind of work roughly. And just say, maybe there's a few sticking points you identify like, okay, we got to work through this. How's that going to work? And then we'll go film it and then edit it, do the thumbnail, post it, affiliate link, all that good stuff. And usually the full turnaround from like start to finish, if we start planning on the weekend and we film Monday or Tuesday, then we'll have the video out by Friday. And then that gives us time to plan the next video that weekend. Wow. So
they're pretty quick. They're coming through rapid fire.
Yeah. And eventually I'd like to batch and film like 3 videos in a week and then, you know, have time to edit and then just be more efficient that way. But it's been difficult. Like I listened to a documentary on Toyota and they have like a Japanese philosophy of like, use every available moment to perfect the project.
Yeah.
So for me, it'd be hard to take an edit and spend, you know, 3 days on it. And it's like Tuesday, it's not due till Friday. And then be like, okay, I'm done with that one. Like I'm always like skidding to the finish line at 2 o'clock on Friday, like upload now, like, you know? So I know I could get better at that, but I don't know, it's just hard. Cause there's always, you can always tweak it. And sometimes I have to limit, like if I start editing Wednesday night, then I know by Friday, like I have to get it done. So I can't do too much, but It's hard.
It forces you to call it done too, I guess, right?
Yeah, and just like hit submit, post it, okay. And then sometimes the videos that you spend the longest on do the worst, and the ones you spend less time on do better. Right. So like the one I spent the most time on was how to hit berms. Like that video took like 15 hours of editing or 16 hours of editing. Wow. And that one did kind of the worst of our how-to series. But then the one that I spend least on, like the Ray's mountain bike park, that took like 6 hours to edit, and that did a million views. So you're like, you're like, oh man, what is, like, I don't know. You just got to put in your best effort, see if you like it, and then just click upload.
So, just roll with it. Yeah.
Yeah. It's never going to be perfect. Like, it's funny.
What do you think are some of the biggest challenges you face in your current direction with YouTube?
I feel like the biggest hurdle would be creator burnout. That seems to be the biggest thing. And then audience fatigue, that's another thing. So like those are the two big, big things that YouTube creators fight. So either your audience gets tired of you because they just have seen what you've had to say, or creator fatigue is like, it's hard to be creative and come up with good plans consistently. Because not only are you battling like physical fatigue of going out riding and filming and all that, but also the mental fatigue of like, okay, plan a video, execute, upload, edit. Okay, next week. And then dealing with like, well, we had to take a little bit of a break away from YouTube the past couple, like I guess 2 months, because with the weather being kind of poor, it's hard to fight through videos, and we don't want to just make like crappy videos because then you start to get people used to seeing crappy videos from you. So we took a little break, and then dealing with like getting taxes set up, getting April set up since she quit her job, like health insurance, LLC stuff, all these. Because to try to do everything at once, I feel like the product would suffer, which is the video, and then the consumer, which is the viewer, would suffer too.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I don't want to waste people's time. That's like our biggest hurdle. It's like, don't waste people's time. You want it to
be worthwhile then, yet.
Yeah. So I don't know. How do you feel about that? Like if you're watching someone for a bit and then they just post three or four kind of like videos in a row, are you more apt to be like, next time I'll just skip that one type thing?
I honestly think that it would probably have more to do if I don't watch two or three in a row because I'm not interested in what those are. I think the YouTube algorithm is probably going to just not show them to me in my subscribers. Okay. I usually go through my subscribers list every morning. So I almost feel like YouTube would have the say in it, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And then I have to be like, oh, I haven't seen anything from Kyle in a while, and go search it and see what's been going on.
Yeah.
I do that quite a bit.
That makes sense. Yeah, that's all this stuff is things we're trying to learn and figure out. But yeah, I hope that kind of answers the question, is we're trying to figure out ways to build in consistency. And that's why like we bought a shop, which is like kind of going to be our HQ office building. And the hope with that is that in the winter we can continue to put out really good like tech oriented videos, and then do podcasts and kind of just have like a more consistent flow, even if the weather's not cooperating.
So tell us about that. Is you got a shop location? It looks like sort of a warehouse setup.
Yeah, it's like a little warehouse, like 1,200 square feet interior. And then there's like, it's a complex, so there's a few of them. And then there's like a clubhouse with the bathroom and stuff. So people are like, oh, there's no bathroom in there. You're like, oh, it's right there, I promise. Yeah. But and then we just got a mezzanine, which is like a second story that we've been waiting on for a few months. But yeah, the goal is to have a bike shop, not a retail bike shop, but like a shop for us to film videos in.
Yeah.
And so doing all the tech how-to stuff. And then we have a little gym where we can do some fun things like, five tips for stretching. Like if you've been riding a bunch and your body's all tight, like what are the five key things to do there?
Yeah.
And then a little podcast area where we'll do kind of a group podcast with a few guys that are local. So almost like if you're into motocross at all, there's a show called the Pulp MX Show. And
I have listened to one of those. Yeah.
Yeah. So they do like a cool little round table thing, and we've been kind of figuring out how to do that. So I don't know. I just want it to be something fun, and that'll help us be more consistent.
So that'll be home base, and you want to move everything out of your actual home and have it all based down there.
Yeah. Cause it's hard like to get the work-life balance correct when you work from home.
Totally.
You know, cause it's like, it's so easy just to go film in the garage and then come straight in and start editing it and then doing all this stuff. And then you completely forget to like rest or to hang out, you know, your partner or whatever it is. Like, and I struggle with that. So
home just becomes a chore.
Yeah. And it's hard to recharge. Like when you feel like, when you feel that you're always at work, it's hard to recharge. And especially with having to be a little bit more creative than I've ever had to be, as far as like conceptualizing videos and how it's going to all go together. It's hard if you're not fresh. I feel like you just, it's hard to put in the same amount of effort and excitement. Yeah. And people can tell, you know, it's like you'll watch some people put videos out and it's like, oh, it seems like they just made this because they had to make it type.
Yeah.
So I want it to always be, oh, we were stoked to do this. Like if we're not feeling it, let's not force it. Let's just do a cool job.
Yeah. So cool. So that's, is that facility part of, you have like a company called Ride MTB now too?
Yeah.
Is that the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. That'll be kind of the warehouse HQ for other people that want to come in as well. And then okay. The cool thing is that at the shop, we're hoping to stock some inventory and start doing some products this year as well. But it's been hard with
your own products.
Yeah, exactly. Because there's some things that I think we could do well that if, you know, if we're doing a good job of like helping our sponsors sell product, and there's a few things that we could do on our own that we could control a little bit better, I would be happy with that.
Yeah.
So that's kind of the goal, is bring things in house. And that was like, do we just store it in the spare bedroom or do we try to get somewhere that's more legit? And it worked out really nice because the shop is like 100 yards away or 100 meters away from the post office. So,
oh, nice.
Yeah. So that'll make life a lot easier. I told April I'm going to buy her like a wagon and then she can hitch it to the bike. Yeah. Ride over to it. But yeah, I don't know. It's exciting. At the end of the day, I just want to get people excited with things. And then the other like biggest goal has been spending more time with April, and she's been working full time for 10 years and kind of at a great place. Like she worked at Fly Racing and they treated her really well, but it's just cool for her to be able to take this experience and this confidence and be like, oh, you can make it on your own. And
right.
That self-employment step is so scary for a lot of people. And I remember when I took that step of like, I'm going racing and I'm quitting my job, that was less scary because even though it was intimidating, I didn't have anything to lose. And then,
yeah, how old were you at that point?
I was like 17 or 18. So it's like, what are you going to lose? Oh, you have your Xbox. Cool. Like, you know, like,
yeah.
There's like nothing there. But when you have a home and then you have your relationships and all these things, like there's so much at risk, and that's when it gets really intimidating. So I think there's been a lot of people have reached out to her and to us saying like that they're excited because they know what it's like and they know how scary it is. And then when you make it actually work in the future, like how rewarding that is. Right. So I'm hoping that we can share that journey. And then, like I said, if we fail, then we'll share that journey too. So
yeah.
It's like, kind of a, I don't know, just be fun to share that with people.
Do you want to talk a little bit more about Ride MTB and what that is? Because if I'm right, there's a coaching aspect to that that there's going to be.
Or yeah, like that. I'm not sure yet. Like, we could talk about it a little bit, but it's also at the point where it's so young at the moment. Like, what we really want to do is we want to bring in, like, that will be eventually what the channel we're hoping will be.
Ride MTB.
Yeah. And we want that to be long term. We want to have like all these assets, which are the videos and hopefully like some other pieces of the puzzle kind of put together.
Yeah.
Where people that have never ridden a mountain bike could come to us and say, this is really cool. I really appreciate it. I learned a lot and I fell in love with the sport. Like that's the goal. And so I was trying to figure out names and ways to do it. And I started searching around and we were like trying to figure out what to call it. And then just randomly, I'm like, you know, Google Ride MTB and it's like domain name available. I'm like, no way.
Yeah. So cause then, Ride BMX as a kid was massive.
Massive. Right. And I'm friends with Brad McDonald who started that, and he started it in Chico.
Oh, no way. I didn't know that.
So like, it's from my hometown, like Ride BMX. And then I was always inspired by Brad and all those guys. And then he sold it to Transworld and then started Vital. So he also started that, but it's just kind of funny, like how things came around. And I was talking to Aaron Kirsten from PNW Components, and he said, dude, if that's available, get it. Like, just make it happen. I'm like, okay, cool. So yeah, we kind of got that to happen. And then I started looking through trademarks and like got the trademark, which is really cool. And we're just kind of rolling with that. So yeah, the goal would be if in the future someone wants to learn how to mount bike, they just go to ridemtb.com and we have all of it there.
So it's pretty safe to say, talking to you, that bikes have had a massive positive influence on your life and that you're super appreciative of that. Is that what you think motivates you so much to encourage other people to get out there and and all that?
Yeah, for sure. I feel like I carry so much of the weight of like what I had to deal with growing up still, and it's still stuff I struggle with all the time. And I mean, even this past week, it was really difficult. My mom, so she's been a painkiller addict for her whole life, basically. And so that's kind of what got my brother hooked on the other stuff too. But this past week she had to go in for back surgery, and she, because her bones are deteriorating from all the painkiller use over the years. Right.
Yeah.
And just this past week, my brother, who's clean now, is doing good. Like, he had to go to the house and, you know, kind of investigate her cabinets, and there's just drugs everywhere. And like, there's everything. And he's sending me these photos of like, this is what it looks like at the house. And he's pouring pills out in the toilet. And I don't know. It's just like, I still have so much of that I struggle with. And then when you like, it's been a heavy couple weeks just dealing with that, and like dealing with my mom and my brother and just all these feelings. And then you see, you go out to the bike park and a kid's like, dude, I love your videos. Like, it gets me so stoked. And it just makes me happy, because I remember when I was a kid and just the feeling of getting inspired by someone, and the fact that like, maybe there's a few kids out there that are struggling that know my story a little bit or know of the story. And they say like, dude, if he can do it, I can do it.
Yeah.
And it's been cool. Like, there's a kid, local kid here, his name's Rob, and he's a BMXer, but his mom struggles a lot too. And he reached out to me on a DM and is like, hey, I just want to say thank you. Like, you inspire me a lot, and I want to try to be pro. And like, that meant a lot to me. Like, it almost made me cry, you know, cause you're like, I don't know. It's just, life is hard for a lot of people, man. And if biking can be a small way to help people get through it, then all I can do to help, that's all I'm out. Like, I'm so excited about it, you know?
Yeah.
But it's just, I don't know.
It's
just,
amazing.
Yeah. I feel like it's something that doesn't get talked about quite enough in the industry, is how much so many of the people that you interact with, and especially even pro riders, like, they have similar stories. Like, I talked to Eric Carter, you know, world champion. Like, he's such a badass on a bike. And then when we talk about growing up, he's like, dude, we share a lot of similarities, and like, I feel the same way. And you would never hear that talked about. They just talk about the racing accolades, but they don't talk about how many people escaped from like bad situations via the bike. So
do you think much of that has to do with the time we're in now? Like, there's a lot more focus on, I mean, there needs to be more, but there's a lot more focus on mental health and these kind of issues and challenges that everyone faces than, say, when EC was dominating the World Cup scene.
Yeah, I definitely think people are more okay with being vulnerable now. And I feel like it's hard too, because sometimes now it almost feels like everyone's just sharing their story all the time. And it's sometimes overwhelming, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's a hard balance. And like, I'll try not to say too much about it, unless it's like in a setting like this, you know, where it's actually could maybe reach a few people and people could understand, like, dude, if you see a kid that's a good kid struggling on just a POS bike and they're out at the dirt jumps every single day, they might be just like Kyle was, you know, like, so it's like, that's how I feel, is anytime I see a kid out there that's struggling and I can tell that they're having a hard time at home, but they're passionate, like, I'll try to help them in whatever way it is. And even, you know, in Chico, there's a lot more kids like that. In Boise, it's quite a bit more insulated from that struggle for whatever reason. It just seems like there's the family dynamic here is a lot better. Still is those issues, but dude, in Chico where I grew up, like, so many of the kids had problems at home. And I don't know, like, I would just find the hard tails on the side of the road and fix them up and give them to kids or
give them to them.
Yeah, it's like, dude, just get like, go be positive, go. So I don't know.
Do you you've spoken a lot about Chico and people with problems. And if I remember right, we've had a conversation in the past where you said something to the effect of Chico was a sketchy place. Like, is it really that bad?
It's like, it's weird. So the neighboring town of Oroville, California, that is like, I guess, considered the meth capital of California.
Oh, there you go.
So there's like the most amount of prescription painkiller abuse and methadone and just all these crazy things, right? So it's like, I don't know. It's a place too where there's not a ton of opportunity within the community, because it's a few hours from kind of everything. So what happens is a lot of people will just kind of float by through life. So I know a lot of guys that are 30, 40, 50 years old that have just been, you know, kind of at a minimum wage job their whole life, or, you know, just worked at, you know, the bike shop. Nothing wrong with that, but maybe they'll just work in the same position for 30 years, 40 years. Yeah. And there's not a lot of upward mobility. So like we talked about earlier, it's hard if you don't have directive and there's no like endpoint goal, then it's hard to kind of like move somewhere positive. So
you still have that directive. That's for sure. You've brought that through your entire life.
Yeah. I mean, that's, you only get one chance at it, right? So it's like,
yeah,
might as well just send it.
On the note of like talking about kids and helping people, did I hear correctly that there's like hopes of starting a foundation or a scholarship program or something in the future as
well? Yeah, I want to, for sure. I've been trying to think of ways to do that. And even I want to talk to Elliot Jackson a little bit more about what he's been doing recently, right, like with Grow Cycling. But
yeah,
that's definitely, that's on the 5-year plan for sure. That's a big part of it. And I want to get to the point where I have an idea. And if anyone who's listening could help pull this together in the future, like my bandwidth is low at the moment, but in the future it'll open up. I want to have a website where, say you have a bike that is not being used, right? And it's just like in the garage. I wonder if there's a way that you could connect that with a person, almost like an adopt a, you know, like it's an adopt a bike type thing where it's like, hey, I have this old hardtail. It's not being used. It's just sitting in the garage. And I know these kids that sign up on this registry that ride a size medium, they, you know, he needs a bike. And then like, I would
connect the dots, boom.
Yeah, exactly. Cause there's so many bikes. Like if you think about how many bikes get sold every year and then how many of them just sit in a garage.
Oh, mate.
And then if you think about how many kids could maybe be impacted by having that bike. So that's kind of one thing I've been thinking about, and I don't mind sharing it because like, even if it doesn't come from me, I think it needs to exist.
It's helpful. Yeah.
Yeah. Cause like, I feel like there has to be a way where you could connect the dots of, here's a registry. If you add on, here's these kids that can register. And maybe even if it's a scholarship thing where like, if you have a 4.0 or 3.0, you can qualify for these things to like help kids strive for something.
Yeah.
But I feel like that could be a good future project.
That's awesome.
Yeah. It'd be cool. I mean, dude, there's so many bikes just sitting in garages doing nothing, right?
I've had this thought for years about like, you know, you're out on your own, your mind's whirring and doing its own thing. And I'm like, where do the old bikes go? Like, where are they? And I mean, this part of the world is unique. I see it differently when I go home to Australia, where there's people riding some clapped out old thing from 2005 that you hadn't seen since 2005.
Yeah.
But here it's like everyone's on $10,000 rocket ships. And you're like, where are all the bikes from even 2 years ago in this part of the world? You know, like, there's people who could use those for sure.
For sure. Here. I know that would be a cool thing. I would be so stoked to be a part of that. So if anyone that is listening would be down to help that. That's kind of one thing that we want to try to leverage in the future with like our audience and our email list and all this. Cause if we could even put a shout out and, you know, say, hey, we're starting a registry. People can come on and register to kind of like you match the bikes. And I feel like that would help a lot of kids. Cause I remember, dude, just drooling over a bike for so long. And then what was funny is the way that we could actually finally afford a bike is that after years and years and years of like my mom just being sick and not getting help, she went and kind of signed up for disability. And then they were able to cut like a check to the family or to me and my mom to like help. So they went back a few months and I think I got $700 for being like the kid of a disabled mom. And that was what I bought my bike with.
Wow.
So it's like that little welfare amount, that $700, like that kickstarted everything. That gave
you a jumping point.
Yeah.
I know. If you don't have that, how do you even get going?
Yeah. And it's like, seems like it should be easier in the future, you know?
Kids need bikes.
Yeah.
I can't finish this conversation without asking, are you still going to race?
Ooh, dude, that's a hard one right now. I feel like my brain keep saying yes, 100%. And then like the time that I have at the moment, I feel like I don't want to half-ass it too.
Yeah.
Cause it's dangerous to half-ass it. But I think that this summer I'll do a few, but I don't see myself racing like EWS or North American Enduro level again, for the time being. I think what I'm doing now, I'm way more focused on, and I almost feel selfish. Like if I were to go spend the hours to train for that, to get in shape for that, it'd be taking away from everything else we're doing. So
yeah, it's a lot of time. Hey,
yeah, it's a lot. Like, to do it properly, you know, I would train between 9 and 15 hours a week on the bike to race. And then, you know, some of the people that do cross country, they're like 20, 30 hours a week. So it'd be hard to do that and do what we're doing now. But
yeah,
I'll go race and have fun, but to try to like make a push at it again would be kind of difficult, I think.
Yeah.
But I don't know. I feel like I kind of got everything out of it that I wanted to get out of it. Like, I'm very content with.
Yeah. I was going to say, you're satisfied with where you were.
Yeah. Like, the career that I had, even though I didn't reach the highest heights, like, I got top 10 at EWS. That was really cool. And then I got 3 national championships. That was really cool. And I'm happy. Like,
you can't ask for more.
Yeah. As a broke kid, I didn't even start riding till I was 16. So it's like, you know,
had you ridden a bike at all before that? Like, dude, you know, usual kid, 5-year-old, whatever.
I was so fat growing up. I didn't really ride at all. Yeah. Like, I didn't really ride at all. I was super overweight growing up. So since the time I was in about 6th grade, I was 170 pounds. Wow. So that's like pretty chunky. I was a chunky kid, and my favorite things in life were video games and football. And I wanted to be like, my goal was, I want to be an NFL player. That was my goal. And then, I don't know, I had tall orders because I'm not like the tallest and I'm not the strongest, but yeah, that was my goal. And then that one coach that I had in my sophomore year just changed it. Yeah. It's crazy the impact that adults can have on you as a kid, positive and negative, but
yeah. Yeah.
I know. I always think about that, but yeah, I didn't really ride much. And then for whatever reason, it just clicked. And I actually told Eric Carter this. The only way I knew of mountain biking is I got a demo disc from PlayStation Magazine and it had Downhill Domination in it.
Oh yeah, I remember that guy.
Yeah, yeah. And so like, I remember I was like, dude, mountain biking is sick. I'll just sit there and play Downhill Domination all the time.
That was your first introduction to it.
Yeah, big time. Yeah, right. And I played as Eric Carter, like riding on, you know. So I told him that, like, he was our team manager for 1 year at Marin. And I was like, dude, you know that you got me into mountain biking when I was a fat kid playing PlayStation. So I don't know. It's crazy. Those little things, because he laughed. He almost started crying when I told him that, because he's like, it's so crazy the impact that he said that video game. I never thought that would have turned into impacting you, which would have turned into impacting these people, which would have like
the domino effect from that.
Yeah. With everything you do, like, there could be a kid. My dream is that when I'm older, there's a kid who wins like a big race or an event and is like, you know, hey, thank you. I watched a lot of your videos when I got into mountain biking. I'd be like, that's so cool. That'd so,
so no racing. Well, not like for full competition purposes, but you used to come to Vancouver and Whistler quite a bit. Have you got any plans to head back up this way?
Yeah, definitely. I know April is like jonesing to go to Whistler. So yeah, that's definitely on the plan. And then Squamish should be really fun to ride some more too. So yeah, as soon as the borders open, we're coming.
All right, we'll show you around. That'd be rad. Cool. I think that's pretty good. We should maybe wrap it up. Where can listeners go to follow or connect with you? It sounds like you got more than just YouTube as well.
Yeah, I feel like the easiest way would be YouTube, and it says Kyle and April Ride MTB. And then the other way would be our website, which is ridemtb.com. And then we just have like an email area so people can reach out there, and we see a lot of those that come through. Sometimes it takes a week or two to reply, but we do our best. It's been crazy this past couple months, but it's all positive.
Awesome. Well, Kyle, it's been great to talk to you and hear more about the positive things you're doing in the sport and where you hope to go with it all.
Yeah, thanks AJ.
That brings us to the end of our conversation with Kyle Warner. If you made it this far, thanks for listening. Be sure to subscribe wherever you listen and let us know your thoughts. You can also check nsmb.com for regular MTV content. We'll be back soon with a new episode for your listening pleasure.